arises why these two particular theologians. Karl Rahner, the answer is obvious. He is generally regarded as the most influential Roman Catholic theologian, even though he is quoted by the liberal wing of the church and was in sympathy with Vatican II. He is still a good Roman Catholic in the sense, in the traditional sense of the word. Teilhard was not a good Roman Catholic. And the question arises, why should we be concerned with him? The answer, I think, could take several forms. One is, he's a very interesting human being, a very remarkable human being, who had capacities for friendship that were tremendous, and who had a kind of awareness of the world, an imaginative intelligence that made him a joy to have as an associate. He was a great human being. In the second place, Teilhard comes to theology in a new and exciting sort of way. The fact is, if you evaluate Teilhard's theology in terms of the traditional categories, you have a very difficult time. French Reformed theologian Crespi from Montpellier has been a very diligent student of Teilhard, but he always tries to understand him in terms of the traditional categories of Reformed theology or Roman Catholic theology. And Teilhard simply doesn't do theology this way. There's a new way of doing theology. And for us, it is a way of doing theology that is set in contrast to the great emphasis during the Bardian era, and also the great emphasis in our own tradition to accentuate the place of history in the doing of theology. The Christ of traditional Reformed Roman Catholic theology is the Christ of history. The Christ who suffered on Calvary and who lived and spoke to men in Palestine. But for Teilhard, you do not have so much the historical Christ as the cosmic Christ. The Christ who is universally at work in the whole of creation and whose presence becomes focused for us at in the incarnation. This is an incarnational theology with a vengeance. But it is not one, it seems to me, that cannot in some way be harmonized with the traditional Reformed theology at any rate. A new emphasis then on the cosmic relationships of the Christ rather than the more provincial, parochial relationships that we have emphasized in our particular theological tradition. There is a third reason, it seems to me, why we should pay attention to Teilhard, and that is he deals with a very alive theological issue. How do we relate Christian faith to the world in which we live? One of the crises of belief in our time has been the sudden discovery by many people that what they were saying theologically and what they were saying as Christians had no relationship to the life that they were living in the world. How to be, as Teilhard would say, a man and a Christian at the same time. In order to be a Christian, do you have to deny your manhood? Is Christianity a curtailment of human existence, a denial of human existence? For Teilhard, the great concern was how to synthesize the love of God and the love of man, or how to synthesize faith in Christ and faith in man, how to put together in one life Christian detachment from the world and immersion in the world, how to put together the kingdom of God and human achievement. This is what his theology is all about. How to put together the kingdom of God, human achievement, faith in the world, in man, and faith in God. How do you put these two together? And how do you participate in the world and at the same time express your Christian faith? As Teilhard puts it in an essay on progress, he says, "It seems to me clear above all else, setting aside the countless minor divergences and ignoring the dull, inert mass of those who believe in nothing at all, that the spiritual conflict afflicting mankind today arises out of the division of minds and hearts into two profoundly separate categories. One, those whose hopes are directed toward a spiritual state or an absolute finality situated beyond and outside the world. Two, those who hope for the perfection of the tangible universe within itself. The first of these groups, by far the older, is preeminently represented in these days by Christians, protagonists of a transcendent and personal God. The second group, comprising those who for a variety of reasons have dedicated their lives to the service of a universe which they conceive as eventually culminating in some form of impersonal and immanent reality, is of very recent origin. Through human history, this conflict between the servants of heaven and the servants of earth has gone on. But only since the birth of the idea of evolution have the devotees of earth bestirred themselves and made of their worship a true form of religion, charged with limitless hope, striving, and renunciation. Are we to disdain the world and put it behind us, or live in order to master and perfect it? Mankind is rent asunder at this moment by these two concepts, or rival mysticisms. In consequence, its vital power of adoration is disastrously weakened. Such, in my view, is the nature of the crisis, more profound than any economic, political, or social struggle through which we are passing. It is a conflict between the human point of view and the point of view of Christian faith. The human point of view for Teilhard was the consciousness of earthly thought, that it forms an organized totality which is endowed with the power to make conquest of the world, the power of growth, and more importantly, which is equal to and responsible for the future. And with the advance in technology, this particular quality of human existence, quality of life, has been greatly accentuated. Man is on the move. He faces indeterminate possibilities for good. The future is his responsibility, and he is equal to it. Nevertheless, the problem is created by man's anxiety about this situation. On the one hand, man is the master of his fate, the shaper of the future, and yet on the other hand, he is very anxious. For he is not only conscious of the fact that there is a force that is moving in this world and that carries him with it willy-nilly, even if he doesn't participate in it, even if he doesn't contribute to it, he's carried on with it. He is aware of this evolutionary force, but he does not know where it is taking him, and he cannot guarantee the future. In any case, there is a stark fact of death, individual death, and collective death on this planet that cannot be sidestepped. Or as Teilhard puts it, tomorrow, but who can guarantee us a tomorrow anyway? And without the assurance that this tomorrow exists, can we really go on living? We to whom has been given, perhaps for the first time in the whole story of the universe, the terrible gift of foresight. Sickness of the dead end, the anguish feeling shut in. This time, we have at last put our finger on the tender spot. What makes the world in which we live specifically modern is our discovery in it and around it of evolution. And I can now add that what disconcerts the modern world at its very roots is not being sure, not seeing how it can ever be sure, that there is an outcome, a suitable outcome, to that evolution. The answer to this dilemma Porteia is to be found in Christian faith. And yet here he has a problem. For Christian faith, Porteia has been distorted. And men reject it, not because it asks too much, but because it asks too little. Not because it is too greatly concerned about justice, about truth and goodness, but because it is too little concerned about justice and truth and goodness. Not because it is too much concerned about man, but because it is too little concerned about man and his humanity. Here, Christian faith has denied itself. The question, therefore, is how to be fully a Christian and fully a man. And Teo believes that this is not only possible, but that this is the Christian answer. Sin for Teyar, quite obviously, is not so much the traditional definition as it is pessimism, doubt, a falling away, a statistical loss, a refusal to get with it and to play one's part in the evolutionary development of the world as it moves toward a collective humanity. Now, this is very exciting to college students who have good personalities and high intelligences and who have not experienced death camps and who think they have the world in their pocket. And therefore, one reason that I did not mention for reading Teo is that he is so frequently and widely read on university campuses. There's a reason for this. What he has to say appeals to those who have the strength to take the world captive and who look forward to building the great tomorrow. But one of the most vigorous critics of Teo in contemporary theology is Hans Jonas, the great German Jewish philosopher who experienced the terror of totalitarianism in Germany and who feels that Teo is entirely too optimistic about human virtue, too little aware of the demonic, and too depreciative of human freedom. But that will have to be. Now let us turn for a moment to Teo, a few facts about Teo's life that I think are rather important for us. Marie-Joseph Pierre Teilhard de Jardin, give it the English pronunciation, was born on May the 1st, 1881, in central France, a few miles from Clermont. He was the fourth of 11 children and grew up in a middle-class home. When he was 11 years of age, he left home and began his formal education at a Jesuit college, and at 17, he decided to enter into a religious order and chose the Jesuits. I don't think we can understand Teo apart from this devout background in a Catholic home and this rearing in the order of the Jesuits. A man who was creative, imaginative, and courageous, and yet who was willing over and over again to submit to the negative judgment of the church upon his work. This willingness to be submissive to the judgment of the church simply is unintelligible to those of us who have been read in another tradition. According to the custom of the Jesuits, Teo went to teach chemistry and science in a Jesuit secondary school in Cairo in 1905. Here he was placed in charge of a museum. He had a great deal of interest in paleontology, archaeological artifacts. While in Egypt, he went on numerous expeditions in the desert, and here he wrote a paper on some of his discoveries that was published. He now began in 1908, 4 years of theological study at Hastings, and he was ordained a priest in 1911, and he returned then to France. While at Hastings, he was drawn into what became known as a Piltdown forgery that Medawar, a British biologist, used against him. Medawar ruthlessly criticized his book, Phenomena of Man, and said it was appropriate to a man who had participated in the Piltdown forgery, and for that reason I think we ought to note it. Here, as he said, he carried on his archaeological interests, associated with Smith Woodward of the British Museum, and he was also associated with some amateur archaeologists and geologists, one of whom apparently planted some bones and so forth that were discovered, and you had the man Eoanthropus, who alleged ancient man. Teilhard discovered a tooth, supposed to have belonged to him, that had been planted. Teilhard always had questions about this discovery of the Piltdown man, and when the forgery was revealed and uncovered in 1953, he wrote a letter in saying that this relieved his mind because he'd never been able to fit in these facts with other facts that he had. Even though, as he said, it spoiled one of my brightest and earliest paleontological memories. He now returned to Paris, and he studied paleontology under the leadership of Bouly and Breuil, two experts at the Sorbonne. 1914, he was drafted, that time in the army, as a stretcher bearer, refusing the rank of chaplain. Here he began to speculate on the human situation, the speculations that finally developed into the phenomenon of man can be traced to this period. In 1919, he went back to his studies and worked for a degree in natural science at Sorbonne. His doctoral thesis was on the subject of mammals of the Lower Eocene period in France. He was then invited by a fellow Jesuit to China to help in the archaeological investigations of the Yellow River Basin. This began a long period of acquaintanceship in China. He stayed only for a year. He was back in France. He wrote and published a number of papers on his investigations in China. But he was now beginning to arouse the suspicions of the church authorities. They did not really want him in Paris, and they certainly didn't want him at the Catholic Institute because of his views on original sin and how you would integrate the doctrine of original sin and evolutionary view of the world. By now, Teilhard was strongly influenced by an evolutionary vision of the world. He had read Bergson's book on creative evolution in 1908, and he says it was this book that aroused him from his dogmatic fixist slumbers, to paraphrase Kant. So from 1908 on, his evolutionary views developed and became a problem to the church early. So they really didn't want him in France. He went back to China in 1926, to Tientsin. He came back and forth to France. He also spent some time in Ethiopia, passed through the United States. So he was not always in China, but this was the location of his main scientific investigations. He then moves to Peking from 1939-1946, and it was this time that he wrote The Phenomenon of Man. Most widely known book, some would say The Divine Milieu, that was written in 1927, and is more theological, is his best book and most important book. And a few months before he died, he said that the vision that he had in The Divine Milieu was still the vision that motivated his life. Phenomenon of Man, though, carries his thought further and is more phenomenological, less theological than The Divine Milieu. And it was written with all of its optimism, precisely at the time when Taiyuan was suffering considerably from the Japanese occupation of China. After the war, he returned to Paris, and he was chiefly in Paris from 1946 to 1951. Here he tried to clear up matters with the church and tried to have the divine media or the phenomenon of man published. But the church would not allow the publication of his books. He did have the foresight, however, to turn over the stewardship of his books to a secretary, which meant, as Taiyuan knew, that they would be published immediately after his death. And I suppose, since he was under the vow of poverty, he was not concerned about royalties from the books. Maybe he didn't anticipate them, though these books were widely circulated in manuscript form. But in addition to refusing to allow him to publish his works, they refused to allow him to accept a position, a highly honored position at the College of France that would have given him a position of considerable influence and a platform which to speak. Matter of fact, they simply didn't want him in Paris. But these were not uneventful days for him. UNESCO had its headquarters in Paris. Julian Huxley, the American evolutionist, English-speaking evolutionist, was in charge of UNESCO. And he and Taiyuan formed a strong friendship. Though Huxley was not a Christian, Taiyuan was. They were united by their general evolutionary vision of the world. Taiyuan was invited to participate in the affairs of UNESCO, and he not only found himself in difficulty with the church, he also found himself in difficulty with UNESCO, which is characteristic of a man who is independent, who does not repeat the party line, and who says what he thinks. He found himself in difficulty with UNESCO over the race issue. He would not agree that all races are biologically equal. He believed that races are biologically different and complementary. As this is rather a critical subject, and as the differences here are nuances, I think it is important to read a letter that Taiyuan wrote explaining his position, as this position has sometimes been used against him. Ruddy wrote to Taurus Baudet. He says, "The various races of man, insofar as we can still distinguish between them and in spite of their convergence, are not biologically equal, but different and complementary, like children of the same family. And there is no doubt that it is even to this very genetic diversity that we must attribute the extreme biological richness of mankind. Nature makes nothing with the same as before. Is it not precisely because there are so many human isotopes, and because still more are being produced every day, that mankind has such great inventive and constructive potentialities? Just as to produce a beautiful picture, you must have a wide range of different colors on your brush. To recognize not the equality of races, but their complementariness through convergence is the only way of explaining the historically evident fact that before the modern tendency to compression that forces them into combination, the different human ethnic groups followed cycles of development that were to some degree independent of one another. So much so, in fact, that some of them would no doubt have become definitely fixed or would shortly sink back into immobility if they had not been revivified and if they did not continue to be stimulated by younger and more progressive groups. There is nothing in this, I think, to hurt anyone's pride, provided, of course, that each one of us understands, like each member of a family, that the only thing that ultimately matters is the general triumph of all mankind, by which I mean that globally it shall attain the highest term, whatever it may be, of its planetary evolution. Furthermore, even in some minds insufficiently humanized, found themselves shocked by the fact that in mankind's common advance, there were not only better endowed individuals, but also better endowed groups, leader groups. Need not disturb us. In sociology, as in physics, there are laws that we cannot trifle with. Well, you may form your own judgment here, but you can obviously see that Teilhard's hesitancy to say that there are no significant racial differences caused him difficulty with men in UNESCO. Teilhard's relationship with the church did not improve, and in 1950, the papal encyclical Humani Generis that put the fist upon the new theology movement that turned backward every creative development in recent Roman Catholicism also was specifically directed against Teilhard. As I said, the church authorities wanted Teilhard out of France, and so they got him out. He came to the United States in 1951, and he remained here until he died in 1955, with occasional visits to South Africa to engage in archaeological explorations. He died on Easter Sunday, April the 10th, 1955. He had earlier expressed a desire to die on Easter, but it seems to me that the accounts of his death and burial are rather tragic. Only a small group, numbered in the teens, were at his funeral, and only two people carried his body to its grave in a Jesuit cemetery north of New York City. Now, let us move more directly to his thought. And I think probably a better method than trying to summarize in a logical order Teilhard's thought is for us to take, first of all, his two great books and look at what he has to say in these two books. And then we can try to draw it together in some kind of conclusion. First of all, the phenomenon of man. There are two facts that stand out in an analysis of Teilhard's The Phenomenon of Man. The first is the very profound impact of the world in its givenness, its wonder, its mystery upon Teilhard. He was alive to the world, to growing things, he was alive to the world that is alive. All the world is alive. The granite is alive. Remarkable things are happening in granite, Teilhard tells us. He was alive to the aliveness of the world. And he was also aware of the world in transformation. The great new fact of our time is man's awareness of evolution. Is evolution a theory, a system, a hypothesis, he asks? It is much more. It is much more. It is a general condition to which all theories, all hypotheses, all systems must bow, and which they must satisfy henceforth if they are to be thinkable and true. Evolution is a light illuminating all facts, a curve that all lines must follow. What makes and classifies a modern man as modern is having become capable of seeing. One of the great words, Teilhard, is seeing. To see the world, to see human existence. Become capable of seeing, not in terms of space and time alone, but also of duration. Oh, and it comes to the same thing, a biological space-time. And above all, having become incapable of seeing anything otherwise, anything, not even oneself. Not even seeing oneself outside this evolutionary development. What has made us in four or five generations so different from our forebears, so ambitious too, so worried, is not merely that we have discovered and mastered other forces of nature. In final analysis it is, if I am not mistaken, that we have become conscious of the movement which is carrying us along, and have thereby realized the formidable problem set us by this reflective exercise of human thought. This then, it seems to me, is the first fact that stands out, this awareness of the world that is in transformation, of a world in which there is a stream, a tide that is moving, and that carries us along, even if we do not cooperate, at least in some measure. The second fact that stands out in the phenomenon of man is Teilhard's deep piety and mysticism. He is representative, characteristic representative of the piety of Roman Catholicism. And while he had a profound appreciation of the world as it is, and he could wonder about the placing of a cross on the top of an obelisk in Rome. Some of you have seen these statues that the Romans carried from to Rome in their conquest. Then when Rome became Christian, people stuck crosses on top of them. Some of you have seen this one right near the palace of the Lateran Palace of St. John. This really shocked Teilhard's sensibilities. He thought the Egyptian monument had a right to stand in its own right, and it did not need to be justified by putting a cross on it. And even while he had this appreciation of the world as it is, he still is representative of Roman Catholic piety. He was characterized by a strong mystical element and very much aware of the divine presence. And thus Teilhard's writings have the quality of vision and poetic insight. I think the only way you can describe the phenomenon of man is a vision of a man who lived both in the scientific modern world and in the Christian community. He expresses this vision in one of his early essays in this way. Studied at sufficient depth, life is on the move. And not only is it on the move, but it is going forward in a given direction. And we are able to follow quite clearly the process or mechanism of its advance. From the lower to the higher, in all forms known to us, there is a perfectly discernible trend of zoological types leading to animals of a more elaborate and concentrated nervous system. What does all this mean if not that throughout the ages, a rising tide of consciousness is at work, a slow ascent made visible to us by the growth of nervous systems? The march of time can and should be measured by a progressive concentration of matter, which becomes haloed with an increasingly radiant light of freedom and consciousness. Consciousness on earth down the ages has never ceased to grow as a direct consequence of the more advanced organization of increasingly complex elements made up of chemical and living energies. Or again, Teilhard writes, throughout my life, the world has little by little caught fire in my sight until a flame all around me. It has become almost completely luminous from within. Such has been my experience in contact with the earth, the diaphany of the divine at the heart of a universe on fire. Christ, his heart, capable of penetrating everywhere and gradually spreading everywhere. This is a vision, the directionality of a universe on the move. Teilhard expressly said that he intended for the phenomenon of man to be a study of phenomena. He writes, if this book is to be properly understood, it must be read not as a work on metaphysics, still less as a sort of theological essay, but purely and simply as a scientific treatise. The title itself indicates that. This book deals with man solely as a phenomenon, but it also deals with the whole phenomenon of man. In the first place, it deals with man solely as a phenomenon. The pages do not attempt to give an explanation of the world, but only an introduction to such an explanation. Well, now, very few of Teilhard's critics would agree that this is a true statement, or that he was faithful to his intention, or that he executed his avowed purpose. In actual fact, the phenomenon of man is not science, and it is not theology, and it is not metaphysics, and it is not poetry. as some of his critics have claimed it to be and as other critics have refuted. In my judgment, the book is Teilhard's reflection on the human phenomenon, in which his scientific awareness of the world is suffused with his mystic and Christian vision. Now, turning more specifically to execution of his purpose in studying the phenomenon of man, we can say that the pervasive theme of the phenomenon of man is the directionality of the process of development of which man is the highest incident. This directionality that Teilhard speaks about in the world is not unbroken. Teilhard speaks of a groping quality in the process. It is a groping directionality. There are loose ends. There is what seems to us to be wasted effort, dead-end streets, brutality. The directionality is not smooth, even unbroken. It is groping. As Teilhard puts it, we find the fundamental technique of groping the specific and invincible weapon of all expanding multitudes. This groping strangely combines the blind fantasy of large numbers with the precise orientation of a specific target. It would be a mistake to see it as mere chance. Groping is directed chance. It means pervading everything so as to try everything, and trying everything so as to find everything. Surely in the last resort, it is precisely to develop this procedure that nature has recourse to profusion. Yet in this groping development of the universe, there can, Teilhard says, be detected and discovered a favored axis of development. The stages of development along this favored axis of development can be described in various ways: matter, life, thought, society. Or you, as Rideau, a French student of Teilhard, puts it, we may note five stages: matter, life, man today, and the end of history. Or the evolutionary process can be traced developing from matter to the biosphere, the sphere of life, to the noosphere, the sphere of thinking that envelops the living world, to the omega point. Now, let us look at this axis, this favored axis of development. This favored axis of development must be understood primarily in terms of what Teilhard calls the law of complexity consciousness. There is an increasing complexification along the axis, and proportionate to the complexification, there is a growth in consciousness. In its own way, matter has obeyed from the beginning that great law of biology to which we shall have to recur time and time again, the law of complexification. Historically, the stuff of the universe goes on becoming concentrated into ever more organized forms of matter. As Teilhard summarizes his argument this way, reduced to its ultimate essence, the substance of these long pages can be summed up with this simple affirmation: that if the universe is in process of spatial expansion, in the same way and still more clearly it presents itself to us psychochemically, as in process or organic involution upon itself, from the extremely simple to the extremely complicated. And moreover, this particular involution of complexity is experimentally bound up with a correlative increase in an interiorization. Interiorization is a word that Teilhard coins. He coins a great many words, as some of you are aware, which is a synonym for consciousness. A centered person, a entity becomes more centered upon itself. That is to say, in the psychic or in consciousness. Teilhard, in other words, wants to understand the axis of development not from the small to the large, not from the infinitely small to the infinitely large, as we so are inclined to think, but from the simple to the complex, complexification. This is one aspect of movement along this axis. The other is cerebralization. Here it is important to note a distinction that Teilhard makes between the within of things and the without of things. The without of things is studied by physics, studied by the chemists and so forth, and the information you get by the studying of the without of things is very important. But along with the without of things, there is the interior of things, the within. And this is important, and this is what has been neglected by the physicists and by the chemists. The apparent restriction, Teilhard writes, of the phenomenon of consciousness to the higher forms of life has long served science as an excuse for eliminating it from its models of the universe. Consciousness, a queer exception, an aberrant function, an epiphenomenon to the process. Thought was classed under one or the other of these heads in order to get rid of it. But what would happen to modern physics if radium had been classified as an abnormal substance without further ado? Clearly, the activity of radium had not been neglected and could not be neglected because, being measurable, it forced itself into the external web of matter, whereas consciousness, in order to be integrated into a world system, necessitates consideration of the existence of a new aspect or dimension in the stuff of the universe. And it is on this that Teilhard concentrates. The within, consciousness, spontaneity, these are three expressions by which Teilhard means the same thing. Consciousness, the within, spontaneity, have no absolute beginnings. They have been here from the very beginning. They do not suddenly start along the way with the advent of life or with the advent of mind. They are here from the very beginning. Everything that's here now has been here from the beginning. Or as Teilhard puts it, it is no more legitimate for us experimentally to fix on an absolute beginning to these three expressions of one and the same thing than to any other lines of the universe. In a coherent perspective of the world, life inevitably assumes a pre-life as far back before it as the eye can see. He puts it again, refracted rearwards along the course of evolution, consciousness displays itself qualitatively as a spectrum of shifting hints whose lower terms are lost in the night. The degree of concentration of a consciousness varies in inverse ratio to the simplicity of the material compound lined by it. Or again, a consciousness is that much more perfected according as it lines a richer and better organized material edifice. What I tell y'all is not too clear about this within of things, and I'm not sure that you can be clear about this within of things. But he is saying that there is, in a very diffused form, even in the simplest molecule or atom or electron, that which later, in a more organized form, becomes human consciousness. In other words, there are no gaps. There are critical points along this axis of development, but there are no gaps. And there is no injection of something from the inside. You do not have to predicate some act whereby God from the outside comes in and puts some kind of new juice into the process that produces something strikingly new. It has been what has emerged as consciousness, and consciousness that is conscious of its consciousness, the power of reflection, or self-transcendence, to use Niebuhr's term, is present in a diffused elementary form from the very beginning. I belong to a group here of scientists, largely MCV people and a few theologians who get together once a month, and we were talking about Teilhard recently, and a biologist in the group said this really threw him, that there wasn't any such thing as consciousness but in the elementary forms of matter. And yet we began to think about it. He said, you know, this thing really catches hold of me here. This awareness of the gradual development of consciousness in the evolution of the world. Scientifically and so forth, this is far beyond me. But I have to say that theologically and philosophically, it has appealing. It's something that appeals. What appears in later forms of evolution is in some elementary form in the earlier forms of matter. Not only does Teilhard distinguish between the within and the without, he also distinguishes between what he calls tangential energy and radial energy. Tangential energy represents the energy that's understood by physicists. Radial energy is that which draws things together in ever greater complexity and would correspond to the within of things. Let me see, I'm running behind schedule. But we move on rapidly along this axis of development, and you arrive at life, the humanization, the humanizing of the individual, life, thought, then reflection. Thought that knows it thinks. The capacity for reflection. This is the great and critical threshold that ushers in a whole new era in the evolutionary history of the world. From our experimental point of view, reflection is, as the word indicates, the power acquired by consciousness to turn in upon itself, to take possession of itself as an object endowed with its own particular consistence and value. No longer merely to know, but to know oneself. No longer merely to know, but to know that one knows. The being who is the object of his own reflection, in consequence of that very doubling back upon himself, becomes in a flash able to raise himself into a new sphere. In reality, another world is born. Abstraction, logic, reason, choice, and inventions, mathematics, art, calculation of space and time, anxiety, dreams of love. All these activities of inner life are nothing else than the effervescence of the newly formed center as it explodes onto itself. With man's power of reflection, evolution enters an unparalleled stage of complexity. The cell becomes someone. Now something new is added to evolutionary development. Under the free and ingenious effort of successive intelligences, something irreversibly accumulates. According to all the evidence, and is transmitted, at least collectively, by means of education down the course of the ages. The point is here that this something, construction of matter or construction of beauty, systems of thought or systems of action, is nothing less than the substance and heart of life in the process of evolution. Teilhard emphasizes two points. The first is that on every hypothesis, however solitary his advent, man emerged from a general group groping of the world. He was born a direct lineal descendant from a total effort of life, so that the species has an axial value and a preeminent dignity. At bottom, to satisfy our intelligence and the requirement of our conduct, we have no need to know more than this. And the second point is that man is to be known not simply in terms of his origin out of the groping of the universe for life, but in terms of his destiny. It is not germinal state that beings manifest themselves, but in their fluorescence, in their destiny. To grasp the truly cosmic scale of the phenomenon of man, we had to follow its roots back to when the earth first folded in on itself. But if we want to understand the specific nature of man and divine his secret, we have no other method than to observe what reflection has already provided and what it announces still ahead. And this leads us to another stage along this privileged axis of development, which is the socialization and the collectivization of life. Man is not made to live in isolation and egocentricity. These are false solutions to the problem. Man is made to live in community. As a matter of fact, love is not simply a unique quality of human existence. It is not peculiar to man. It is a general property of all life, and as such it embraces in its varieties and degrees all forms successively adopted by organized matter. In mammals, so close to ourselves, it is easily recognized in its different modalities, sexual passion, parental instinct, social solidarity. Farther off, that is to say, lower down on the tree of life, analogies are more obscure until they become so faint as to become imperceptible. But this is to repeat what I've said earlier when we were discussing the within of things. If there were no internal propensity to unite, even at a prodigious rudimentary level, indeed the molecule itself, it would be physically impossible for love to appear higher up in harmonized form. Well, here's where I think I should have to leave it. For today, we carry on at this point. This axis of development that moves from matter to living things, to thought that has the power of reflection, to the distinctly human, to the socialization of man, to the collectivization of man, of which totalitarianisms for Teilhard were aberrations, to the collective consciousness, or to the omega point. The omega point is Teilhard, the counterpoint of counterpart of the second coming of Christ. But the omega is not simply at the end. The omega is a power that is at work within the process that beckons us on. So here you have in Teilhard the counterpart of Moltmann's God of the future, the God who beckons and calls, not simply the God who pushes. Well, this is strange theology for those of us who have been immersed simply in Reformed theology, but it is new emphasis that I think we need to be aware of, and it needs to modify our theological thinking. And tomorrow we shall continue with Teilhard.
Sing this.